We're joined today by Alice Glover and Megan Deutsch Blanco. They're both immigration attorneys here in Chapel Hill. Marcy Tucker is also here. She is a retired anesthesiologist, and all of them recently went down to the border and are joining us here in the studio. Alice, Megan, Marcy, thank you for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So what motivated you to make the trip in the first place?
Probably the one person who is not here. We went with a fourth person who learned about the project and got excited about it and talked to Megan, who then talked to me, and Marcy and I have known each other for years. So we knew that they needed help down there, and we packed our bags and decided to go down and throw caution to the wind and see what we could do to help.
What was the project?
The project is a border rights project that's part of a larger nonprofit called Al Otro Lado, which means the other side. It's based in California, but this project is working out of the Tijuana area because most of the immigrants coming up from South America and Central America are coming into Tijuana, some other points on the border as well. But we went down to work with this particular project to help immigrants learn what it is to make a claim for asylum and to help them understand what the requirements are going to be and how to move forward with that.
Because this is part of the issue, too, is that the vast majority of the people who are coming are coming to claim asylum, and there's a procedure for that which is kind of being upended right now, right?
That's absolutely right. What we're finding is that it should be the way the law has always worked, is that you should be able to make a claim for asylum as soon as you reach the border. But what's happening is the government's not allowing that process to take place. So there's been a line that's developed, essentially. When we left Tijuana, there were about 3,000 people waiting in line to be able to make a claim for asylum. So that's one of a number of things that we saw that is problematic.
When did you go down?
We went down about a month ago.
Okay. For how long?
We were there for a week.
Okay. What was it like? What did you experience?
It's kind of like organized
Marcy?
Chaos, I guess. Rules changed, you know, every day. We showed up and we were a bunch of, you know, people with random qualifications from all over the country that wanted to help the immigrants. So we all converged at this one sort of dilapidated building that was converted into a legal clinic and a medical clinic and a soup kitchen. And we were assigned basically jobs, or, you know, we would make use of our skills. Like, for example, I worked in the medical clinic, so I came to do whatever they needed me. Now my background is anesthesia, so of course I wasn't in an operating room and I wasn't doing anesthesia. So basically it was like primary care, frontline medicine, running out to pharmacies to replace over-the-counter medicines that had been depleted, trying to document the immigrants' wounds and provide documentation for medical conditions that they potentially would need, documentation that they would need more medical care in their travels or their continued quest for asylum.
What were some of the conditions that they were facing?
Well, a lot of these migrants had walked, you know, for hundreds of miles. You know, they had long, you know, arduous journeys. They, you know, a lot of them had been tortured in their home countries. So there were a lot of orthopedic injuries. There was a lot of gastrointestinal problems from malnutrition and from eating rotten food and from, you know, basically not eating well. There was a lot of, you know, dehydration issues from not having access to clean water. There were a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms. So a lot of them, you know, had insomnia, you know, hadn't slept for days or weeks, and they were stressed because they were fleeing horrible conditions.
Did you see kids?
We saw a lot of kids, you know, in mother's arms, and then some teenagers, and then some young adults, basically, that looked like they were fleeing.
So how many people were you seeing, like, on a given day?
Well, we saw probably 40 or 50 a day.
Wow.
200 plus a week, you know, at the medical clinic. And then some of us would go out to shelters in the area as well. And so 200 a week in those shelters.
And the legal clinic about the same. The legal clinic we saw anywhere from 40 to 60 families a day in consultations. We also saw, surprising to me, there were I'd say, I think there were 14 countries represented the week that we were there. And these are not the, this was in the afternoons, the Al Otro Lado sponsored a legal and medical clinic. So these were people that there would be a morning outreach program that the volunteers would go and tell people, you know, there's no information booth on this this line system that's formed. Certainly there's a lot of misinformation. So part of the volunteers' job was to go and tell people or, you know, kind of what to expect, as Alice mentioned, with the process, what to expect when they would, their number would be called and they would then be detained in what are called the hileras, the ice boxes, which are kept at 9 degrees Celsius, which is about
48.2 degrees Fahrenheit.
And just to really, really try to set people's expectations, which was difficult because here we are, these foreigners showing up in the morning and telling people that have traveled for so long and have different language and cultural barriers to in addition to the post-traumatic stress, to understanding what we were saying, but what to expect when they were detained by immigration, and also what to expect after that when they did get their credible fear interviews to begin the asylum process.
What's a credible fear interview?
A credible fear interview is the preliminary vetting done by immigration, where an individual has an opportunity to explain why it is that they're seeking asylum, why it is that they are in fear of returning to their home country.
Speaking with Megan Deutsch Blanco, you just heard her, Marcy Tucker, you just heard her as well, and Alice Glover, all just coming back to Chapel Hill from a trip to the border, Tijuana in particular, where they were working with immigrants, asylum seekers down there. What did you see, what did you experience that surprised you?
There were a number of things that surprised me, but in particular, I would never have believed the situation was as bad as it is if I hadn't gone down there. You hear about it on the news, but it's hard. It's particularly hard to see it all. Families that we had to counsel might be separated from one another if they didn't have good, clear documentation that the children were the children of the parents. Unmarried couples that had children. Separations of families might occur, and it would be for a period of days, possibly longer, not just a period of hours while things got worked out. Also, it surprised me that we are holding people in these icebox rooms, which are windowless. They are well lit 24 hours a day. They do not allow showers. You have meals, cold meals. But these people are held in these rooms with only the clothes that are closest to their body. So everything else was confiscated. So we spent time each morning trying to explain to people, if you've got a jacket on, take your jacket off, take that shirt, T-shirt off, and put the jacket on closest to your body. We also were surprised to see that the government actually did confiscate not only clothing and electronics, but also medication. And we saw that on several occasions, people who were sent back across the border were not given their medications. Mm-hmm. So it was eye-opening. Yeah. That's just really the tip of the iceberg.
I would never have believed that people were kept in those ice boxes had I not heard the stories from these patients that were released from them, coming back to the medical clinic saying that they lost all their medicines because the authorities had taken them the medicines from them. And then when they're let out, they have nothing. They just come back to the clinic in hypertensive crises and in diabetic crises. You know, they have medical conditions that for which they need medicines for, and the authorities basically had no regard for that. So we were writing. Part of my job was to write letters, you know, document that these patients would need the medicines, and to plead with the authorities not to take them from the patients.
And they're being kept in the letters from anywhere from 2 to 10 to 14 days.
Wow.
So this is a long time. And this is, just to be clear, not just adults, but children, families.
Right. So in the context of the larger immigration debate, one of the things that supporters of the current policy are saying is, well, Obama did it too, right? So it was exactly the same 5 years ago as it is today. What is the difference between today and 3, 4, 5 years ago?
I take issue with that. I don't think we were putting people in ice boxes 5 years ago. I do think that we've had a border crisis for a number of years. And I think the past administrations have tried to do what they could to be more humanitarian about how this process works. I do think that we started to see ice boxes probably in the fall of 2016, so about the end of the administration. But from that point forward, it's been a ramped up process. And what I think has also happened is there are no resources to be able to process these individuals. So this line, which is a which we believe is illegal, has continued to grow. And there were days we were at the border where they only allowed 5 to 10 people to try to come forward to make their claim for asylum. So it's not like we're letting hundreds of people each day. Sometimes the most I ever saw allowed to process were 50 mm-hmm. people on one day, but usually it was a much smaller group. And the government, our government, claims it's because of capacity issues.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think now people are coming from so many different places. It, to me, one of the most surprising things was we're seeing the immigrants come from Africa. Like, we saw quite a few from Cameroon and from. And then we saw from Yemen, and we saw from Guinea, and we saw, you know, from Senegal. And so there were desperate people from all over the world trying to get to Tijuana because apparently they were told that, you know, that's a place they could cross. So you have this people from Central America coming up. You have Mexicans also trying to cross. And then you have people from all over, from places, you know, outside of the places that people usually think of. And people that are persecuted all over now, like, I think, increasing the numbers that the Customs and Border Patrol people are seeing, and I think they're just overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I thought was interesting as well is we are told that we have a lot of criminals coming up through the border and that they're not vetted. What we found was that that's not true, that the State Department has officials in many of the countries south of Mexico who are doing plenty of vetting, plenty of fingerprinting. So there is a handle going on in terms of our government's approach to who gets to move forward and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Alice Glover, Megan Deutsch Blanco, and Marcy Tucker, what else should people know about the situation that you saw? I know most of us get our information about this from media coverage. What is not being covered in the media? What is maybe being miscovered by the media that people want to know?
I would say that that family separation is still happening.
Mm-hmm.
We were, you know, some of these things, you know, in our line of work, we hear about them, but really to see the shock on families' faces when you have to explain to them because they, you know, are not carrying a birth certificate, because they do not have a marriage certificate, all these reasons that it is likely that they will not be held in together with family members, and to prepare families for that, the reality that families still are being separated. I think was surprising, and just to feel what that feels like for a family. This is not even the separation part, but to have to prepare themselves that wherever they have come from is so horrific that they are willing to take the risk of being separated from their family for a better life, I think for me was very impactful.
And I think you know, in the news, you know, people like these migrants are painted, you know, as criminals or as drug dealers, and I think you know, I saw over 200 in the clinic that week, and I didn't see any that I was afraid of or that I would, you know, call security on. I think these people are making long, dangerous journeys, and they're leaving families behind, and they're carrying everything they own on their back, and they're walking hundreds of miles, and they have tears in their eyes when they talk about their home. So I don't think they want to leave their home. You know, I think that they have to leave their home. I mean, mm-hmm. I think a lot of them, it's a life or death situation.
And I'll also add that we were there at an interesting time. It was at the beginning of the Remain in Mexico policy, which is a policy that this administration has come up with to send people back after they after they're interviewed by something similar to a credible fear interview. You know, maybe they'll pass, maybe they won't. Go back and wait in Mexico is the idea for a month. And we really saw a lot of building animosity and just the numbers of people that are there and just not, you know, the local community's response, as you can imagine, as well as the individuals who are then caught in limbo, don't quite know what to expect. You can imagine just the issues with any type of due process of letting people know their court dates, letting mm-hmm. people know what to expect next, but also just feeling the on-the-ground feeling from locals, from people who had lived perhaps in Mexico for a period of time and were feeling growing animosity toward these policies that are really putting a lot of pressure on an area that already, you know, has economic pressures.
Well, and they don't really have resources, so when they're sent back to Mexico, it isn't like they can go to their home or to their friend's home. So they are stuck looking for shelters or looking for anything that they can in terms of being able to have a roof over their heads while they wait to be able to then go back over to the United States. And things happen. Sometimes cases get delayed or rescheduled, and so trying to track those individuals down to try to keep them in line with when their next hearing is a nightmare, and we've already seen some effects from all of that.
If people want to help, where can they go? What can they do?
My suggestion when people ask me about that is that if you want to, one thing that's important to know is just once you get through the credible fear, most of these people will never have attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have to make their case on their own. So the Southern Poverty Law Center has a project that is the
Southeastern Immigrant Freedom Initiative, I believe.
Right. And so if you go to the Southern Poverty Law Center website, you can put in immigration and see where you can make some donations. Those donations are used to help support families and folks who are in detention that are in the South, helping with pairing attorneys, but also with families that are part of that process.
Because the reality is, you know, we were doing what we could to meet with people as needed, but the reality is that most of these people, if they do pass their credible fear interview, will never meet with an attorney,
mm-hmm.
Especially in areas like the Southeast. So certainly, you know, helping them down the road and looking forward. I think also just, you know, calling your representatives and letting them know that this, you know, family separation was a hot issue a few months ago, and now we don't hear as much about it in the news, but just that you've heard people, that you know people, to, you know, this is still happening and it's still, you know.
Well, in deplorable conditions, putting someone at 48.2 degrees with lights 24/7, I would say that's torture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would say just get the word out, you know that like we were there, and if you believe us that the conditions are horrible for these migrants, and try to spread the word. Also look up All Otro Lado on, you know, Google on the internet, and Frontline Wellness is the medical organization that partners with them. But often they don't have enough resources, enough people to man the clinic. So if you're in the healthcare field, you know, look them up and see if they need help or what types of donations, medical supplies that they need, and send them.
We've got to start wrapping up the conversation. Other things that people ought to know that we haven't been able to touch on yet. Alice?
Well, I was struck by the fact that there were so many people from other countries making their way over. So that is what I think it says, is that we've got a lot of issues going on right now that are worldwide. I'd say two other things. If we do believe it really is a humanitarian crisis, why don't we work with the UN to put together a refugee model? Also, I think my other take-home message is why don't we consider taking the money that we're going to put into building a border, the billions of dollars, and instead put that into a Marshall Plan like what occurred at the end of World War II, and some of these countries that are suffering so much that they are willing to go hundreds of miles to try to make a claim for asylum in the U.S.
Again, you can head to the Southern Poverty Law Center, right, and visit the Southeast Immigrants
Freedom Initiative.
Freedom Initiative. Thank you to get more information on how you can help. Many other ways that you can do it as well. Alice Glover, Megan Deutsch Blanco, Marcy Tucker, thank you all so much for being here today and for doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you.